Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the Marianist family marks the 250th anniversary of its founder, French priest Father William Joseph Chaminade. Find out about the work of the Marianist men and women in countries around the world. And the International Year for Forests, as the UN focuses on crucial conservation and sustainable management questions, we delve deeper into the religious and spiritual dimensions of this environment. Issue. Religious and lay people, men and women, working together in recognition that there is only one vocation lived out in a wide variety of complementary gifts and ministries. That spirit of collaboration amongst all baptized members of the Church lies at the heart of the Marianist family and its mission in over 40 countries around the world. The original Society of Mary was founded by a French priest, Father William Joseph Chaminade, who was born in 1761 but suffered persecution and exile during the French Revolution. That original society has now grown, and the different branches of the Marianist family today include priests, brothers, sisters, as well as consecrated laymen and women. With a strong focus on education, they run schools and universities, as well as other centres and programmes providing physical and spiritual care for children and young people in countries across the world. But Marianist men and women are to be found in many other areas of ministry as well, as the current Secretary General of the Society of Mary, Brother Michael McAward, explains.
We're marking the 250th anniversary of our founder's birth. Our founder is Father William Joseph Chaminade. He was a diocesan priest from the Bordeaux area in France. He was exiled from France, as were many other priests during the time of the French Revolution. He sought solace in Saragossa in the north of Spain, where he prayed fervently before Our Lady of the Pillar. It was during the 3 years in exile there that he had the inspiration to return to France when possible and evangelize those who were already evangelized, in other words, to re-Christianize post-revolutionary France. And as a result of that, he came back and immediately began forming what were called sodalities, what we would call today sodalities, for all different types of people. For youth, for professional people, fathers of families, for women who had been working in the streets. You name it, he had a sodality for it, and he became known as the priest of the sodality of Bordeaux.
Many different areas of interest then. What is the particular charism, would you say, of the order today?
Well, we would say that our main charism is to be missionaries, to bring people to Christ through Mary. That would be our overall charism. Our inspiration comes from Mary's saying yes at the Annunciation, and also at the wedding feast of Cana, where Mary said, "Do whatever he tells you," referring to her son. And so our work around the world is rather varied because we do whatever he tells us. But as a matter of fact, we're very well known, particularly for education on all levels, both formal and non-formal education. We also have many other charitable works in terms of, particularly in the emerging areas of the world, we have works, let me give an example. In India, we have our REDS program, which is taking care of the young children who are rag pickers. In the Philippines, we have a home for street kids. We have health facilities. We have universities, many, many schools. We're a small order.
How many members?
We're about 1,200 members worldwide, but we're in about 38 or 40 countries. So we're spread out. In some places thinly, but we're spread out and trying to pass on our charism. As missionaries, we see ourselves as missionaries in the mission of Mary to bring people to Christ.
How is this anniversary of your founder's birth being marked?
It's being marked on a number of occasions, specifically throughout this anniversary year. But in all, it's being marked from January 22nd, 2011 until January 22nd, 2012. And it is being marked locally according to local customs. So, for example, if you have a school and it's a Marianist school, they're having various celebrations. Many of the celebrations took place around two specific dates so far. That would be January 22nd, which was the opening of the year, which is the date of our blessed founder's death, as well as in April when he was born, the actual 250th anniversary of his birth. There will be other special days throughout this particular year. A number of them are in September and in October, when the first Marianists took their vows for the Society of Mary, the men's order, as well as on the day that our, what we would call our patronal feast in October. When I speak of Marianists, I speak very broadly because we are the Society of Mary, the brothers and priests, but we are only one of four different branches of what we call the Marianist family, all who find their inspiration through our founder, Father Chaminade. There are also the Daughters of Mary Immaculate, who are the Marianist sisters. There's a confederation of Marianist lay communities throughout the world in many countries, as well as the Alliance Mariale, which is basically in France and French-speaking Africa, but also now expanding. It's a very small group, a pious association of people with private vows.
Lay people with private vows,
that's mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. And so they all form together what we call the Marianist family, and we do things together. We are celebrating this Chaminade year commonly.
Ask you perhaps a bit more personal question. Why were you first attracted to this figure, perhaps to this particular order?
Well, that's a very, very good question. And I think that it's taken the course of a relationship. My vocation is really an outgrowth of a relationship which started out in high school. I was taught by the Marianist priests and brothers at the high school at Chaminade in New York. And I liked the brothers as friends, as teachers, and I liked what they did. I then thought myself very capable, and I imagined doing what they did. And ultimately, upon graduation from high school, I decided to join the order. And it was all based on the relationship. And I have to say, honestly, my relationship with Father Chaminade at that time was not the most attractive thing. It was the relationship between myself and the brothers and what they did. And I saw myself doing that. As a matter of fact, I did that for almost 30 years before I was called to Rome.
Teaching in
high school. And I loved it and someday hope to go back to it. That said, as part of my formation and then ultimately my ongoing formation over these 30-some-odd years of my religious life, I have developed a relationship and deepened the relationship on a number of levels, relationship with our founder, a relationship with Mary, and a relationship with God, as well as a more global relationship with our society throughout the world. For me, I've never stopped developing that. It's an ongoing process. So a priest once told me many, many, many years ago that when he was preaching at a wedding, he said, "The love that brings you two together today is not the love that's going to keep you together for the next 50, 60 years." And that has been my experience in life, particularly my religious life, that the love that I found as for the brothers and for their work as a high school kid has developed into a different type of love, of religious life, of our charism, and of our fraternity that we share. And I have to say the thread that I find through that, and ever increasingly so, is the charism in the person of our founder. Our founder was beatified in 2000, and it was a most joyful experience. And it was also a great awakening for many people, not only within the orders, but the lay people with whom we are associated. It was a great awakening to the person and charism of our founder. As part of my job right now as Secretary General of the Society of Mary, I am working very closely with our postulator general towards the canonization of our founder, and we are very excited because we have recently submitted to the Congregation for Saints' Causes what we hope might be approved as a miracle on his behalf, which will lead to his canonization should it be approved. But we're in the early stages of that process, and we're praying for that as well as for the eventual canonization of our founder.
So the end is perhaps in sight on this path to sainthood.
Well, I'm going to say a cautious yes. I don't want to count the chickens before they hatch, but we're very, very excited about it. The cure involves a young woman, magnificent story of a young woman in St. Louis, the United States. And the Archdiocesan Tribunal has completed their work, sent the results and the testimony to the Holy See. And so, of course, at the Holy See, you have to get online. And so we'll wait our turn. I can't say we're waiting patiently. We're very excited. But we would be realistic that it's not going to be very soon.
My thanks there to Brother Michael MacAward, Secretary General of the Society of Mary. Throughout the year 2011, the United Nations is marking an International Year for Forests, celebrating especially the essential role of forests for our human existence. Over two-thirds of all biodiversity on land is found in the forests, but over 1.5 billion people also depend directly on the forest for their livelihood. That's why the logo for this UN year features the central role of us human beings in the sustainable management and conservation of our world's forests. But there's another deeper dimension for Christians to consider, a dimension that goes right to the heart of our faith.
Nature, the natural world, it is not simply God telling us something, but it is God revealing himself. And even in Thomas Aquinas, we find the first glimmerings of this.
Dr. John Feehan is a well-known author and professor at University College Dublin's School of Biology and Environmental Science. He's particularly concerned that churches around the world this year should get involved with what is potentially the greatest emergency facing our planet today.
Deforestation has really become such a fundamental problem because of population growth. It is essentially the burgeoning growth of the human population that has led to this vast increase in deforestation over the last 40, 50 years particularly. And much of the concern, especially since the conference in Rio de Janeiro, 12, 13 years ago now, concern about the practical implications of the loss of function, forest function, the loss of resources, etc., has become increasingly to the forefront. But one of the things that I have noticed myself over the last number of years is that other values in forest and in forest biodiversity have tended to kind of slip between the cracks, so to speak. We're so concerned now with what the practical implications of the loss of forest would be for climate, for resources, for populations, etc., etc., that we've tended to lose sight of the fact that the forest is the great reservoir of biodiversity on Earth. And all of God's revelation in nature, if you like, is dimming like a rainbow dimming before the sun, so to speak. So I've been trying to readdress the concern, not ignoring, of course, all the practical side of things, but to look more, again, at the spiritual dimension of the loss of forest and the biodiversity resources that it harbours.
On the practical side, you have some very alarming figures about the complete loss of all forests in just over 100 years or so.
It is stunning, and not just 100 years, I mean, in decades. We have lost, for example, Madagascar. The loss in Madagascar has been over decades rather than over a century. The figures are absolutely astounding. But we seem to be able to kind of skate along and not take the seriousness or the implications of this loss on board, certainly not in any practical sense. Because in spite of all the resolutions we have taken, the declarations that we've passed, we still see this steady trickle away of biodiversity between our fingers. I mean, for example, if one looks at the glossy national biodiversity action plans of all the nations of the earth, I mean, they're very, very impressive on paper. Some of them running to hundreds of pages, and what we have and what we're going to do. But if you actually look at ground level, at community level, on the ground, and see what is actually happening, we find that still the trickle is continuing, in spite of success stories here and there. But the overall,
for example,
trend, some of the work of the International Union for Conservation of Nature, for example, the establishment of parks, the focus on charismatic species and bringing them back from the brink, etc. Those are small success stories, and they tend to get headlines. But the steady trickle, the steady loss, especially in terms of area, of land lost to natural forest, still continues.
You talk about this spiritual dimension or the moral dimension of this loss of biodiversity. Tell us a little bit more about what you understand by that.
Well, taking a few steps backward, I suppose, if we look back at the perception that began to develop, particularly, we say, in the 16th century, that the natural world, nature, the universe that we confront, that confronts us, or that is before us, it is not simply the stage, the furniture on which the human drama is enacted, but is, in fact, it is the first revelation, so to speak. I mean, that is all there is in terms of revelation in a literal sense, if you think of the human in the world looking out. What nature is, it is everything. And anything spiritual that we have ever moved into the second revelation, so to speak, is distilled ultimately from that. And many theologians would take it much further, to the extent of saying that nature, the natural world, it is not simply God telling us something, but it is God revealing himself. And even in Thomas Aquinas, we find the first glimmerings of this, to quote loosely, that God cannot express himself in any one creature, and so he has created this multitude of different species so that what one lacks as an expression of divine goodness, the others can make up. I mean, what that is saying, that this is the self-revelation of God. And that's in Thomas Aquinas' day, before we really had any real sense of just how mesmerizingly complex and impressive biological diversity is. I mean, we knew nothing about invertebrate life, which is that is biodiversity, or about lesser plants, so to speak. We knew nothing about the biodiversity of the tropics. We knew absolutely nothing about the biodiversity of the oceans, for example. So if Thomas were alive today and confronting the same question, what is God about, in both senses of the word, with the natural world, I mean, he would be stuck for words. You know, how to express it now? The other side of it is, and this is where science comes in, what science being the human ability to read what is being said to us in nature. And what science has shown us over the last, again, within the last century, is that these other species are not just wooden figures, not just static furniture on the stage. They are all as complex as we are in terms of their biochemistry, their genetics, their physiology. And what has dawned on us over the 120 years since Darwin, of course, is that they're not just furniture on the human stage, but they are our brothers and sisters. We are related. And this utterly changes the question that confronts us about how do we respond to a creation which is all of this. It's not what we used to think 50, 100 years ago, but God is about so much more here that it puts an absolutely moral responsibility on us to take all of that seriously in how we respond to deforestation, which brings us back to the forest. Yeah? The forest is where it all, in a sense, kind of focuses on.
You talk about trees as a way of life, don't you, and the forest in our genes.
Yes.
Tell us, what do you understand by this?
Trees as a way of life, I mean, it sounds a simplistic question to ask. You know, what is a tree? Because we all know what is a tree. But there's much more to it, because trees are the dominant, long-lived life forms on Earth that gather around all the rest of biodiversity to themselves. So they are the permanent architecture of the natural world, so to speak. Everything else comes and goes, you know, over months away. They are there for hundreds, for thousands of years. So, I mean, they are really the pillars of biological diversity on Earth. That's what I mean by it's a way of life in an ecological sense. And the psychological end of it, again, if we look at human evolution, we were born in trees, in a sense. Put it this way, physically we are made for an atmosphere with 20% oxygen. I mean, physically, everything about it. If that is gradually reduced, say to 15%. We're not made for that, physically. But it's the same psychologically. Psychologically, we are made for a landscape which is dominated by nature, of which trees are the long-lived permanent residents and everything that goes with them. And our biological nature has, in fact, evolved to be comfortable in that kind of situation. If you take us away from it, we're no longer, almost literally, we are no longer at home. We don't feel at home. We feel less comfortable. Something is missing from our experience. So in that sense, we are almost genetically programmed to have trees around us. Forget about the spiritual side of it for the moment, but in purely psychological terms. And I mean, it's no accident, therefore, that if you walk through a park in the middle of a city, for instance, you respond to this sense of greater ease or being more at home in the natural world, etc. So we suffer if it's taken away, basically, psychologically and spiritually, because of these deeper revelation of God dimensions that we've been talking about.
You talked about the church's response to this. Over the centuries, the church has had great difficulty, despite, as you say, right back to the earliest centuries, having some glimmer of understanding of the profound effect that this would have on our theology, on our thinking.
Yeah. Well, we're still only at the beginning of it, I think. I mean, there's always the danger of thinking that at long last, after 2,000 years, we finally got the final theology. But put it this way, the Scottish historian Dermot McCulloch published a huge, thick, big book 2 years ago on the history of Christianity. Wonderful for putting everything in perspective, but the subtitle of it was Christianity, the first 3,000 years. The first 3,000 years. What he's saying there really is, not only is Christianity not confined to 2,000 years, but it took 1,000 years to prepare for it, so to speak, and there is another 2,000 years ahead, if we can use our reason and get things right. But one of the points he's making is, and this is very hard for maybe a lot of theologians to accept, is that in the theology of 1,000 years hence, if we can manage to get there, will be as different from the theology of today as ours is from Nicaea. You know, in other words, it is not set. One of the danger with the councils is that they set thinking in concrete, and it prevents it from maturing in response to a better understanding of creation. And this is what this is about. Our understanding of creation has been simply revolutionised in the last 100 years. But theology is very slow to catch up with it.
Why do you think this is?
Well, change demands, it's challenging. It demands courage, etc. It's more comfortable to say, well, look, we've got this far and you know, this is better than it was before. As Bernard Lonergan once put it, you know, the church always arrives on the scene a little late and a little breathless. Very much the case here.
There's very much a fear, isn't there, of moving away from the human-centric into the world of creation as such.
And also into the much more demanding openness to divinity that this requires. The understanding that science has confronted it with requires a more mature understanding, insofar as the human can ever understand what is behind it all, of God is. And that can be frightening. But I mean, go back, I mean, St. Paul has it there in a nutshell. You know, when you were a child, you thought as a child and did all the things of a child, and you played like a child, but now you've grown up. You know, you can't turn your back on what science tells us about. I mean, for instance, if you're talking to a group of grown-up adults, all of whom are well-educated, etc., and you try to confront them with the reality that you and a spider, you are sisters, it always brings a very uncomfortable snigger.
It's seen as a bit New Agey, isn't it? A little bit.
Yeah, and the bombshell hasn't sunk home. You know, the reality of it, that this is not just an uncomfortable. It is. It's true, and it bounces back to us the question. You know, well, who did we think we were in the first place? You know, and the Book of Job has an awful lot to say. That's very illuminating on that. You know, who do we think we are? But finally, we're confronted with this realization that our understandings of God up to now have been those of a child, really.
What would you like to see the church perhaps offering in terms of this greater understanding, this ability to add an extra dimension, if you like, to what is undoubtedly a great concern about the future of our planet?
Well, taking it on board in theology in the first instance, which we've been very slow to do. I mean, theology really hasn't opened itself up to only a fraction of the extent it needs to what the advances of science in the last the last century has been. But in addition to that, the need to take much seriously action at ground level, fundamentally at community / parish level, because that's where this sort of thing translates into success. If you, having taken some of these insights on board, you then look back to where I live and where I'm grounded, the parish I live in, the community I live in, and ask, what do I need to do now to show that I take this seriously in my own life and in the lives of those close to me, which is why I tend to focus a lot on getting the parish level involved. For instance, every country has its national biodiversity action plan, and that's devolved down to local authorities. The local authorities are supposed to have the local area biodiversity action plan. I don't know, well, I know of very few instances where the church at local level has said to itself, okay, here is the biodiversity action plan. We have a moral, religious dimension to bring to this. How are we going to get involved with it? How are we going to translate it into, how are we going to talk about it in our communities? How are we going to talk about it in our churches? It's not happening at all.
And yet it would be a way of perhaps bringing people back into the church, would it, through this connection to the natural world?
Well, absolutely. And also, it would be a way of showing that the church takes the advance of science more seriously, takes the implications for knowledge or understanding of the advance of science more seriously. Because one of the things that young people find, especially educated young people, find difficult is that the church doesn't seem to take some of the findings of science seriously. It takes the technology seriously because it's useful and can use it, but not some of the implications for how we understand ourselves in relation to God, in relation to others, in relation to the natural world, etc., etc. This would show that that is being taken much more seriously, and that would bring an awful lot of young people back into, well, I won't say back into the church, because it would be a changing church, if you like, a different fold.
But to connect up the theological issues with these very practical concerns.
Yeah, because, I mean, it is all of a piece. The perception that theology and church has had nothing got to do with what the world is really all about and what matters in the world, that's the big gap in the understanding of an awful lot of young people.
Going back to the Year of the Forest and our hopes, our perspectives for this year, perhaps what other practical efforts, can you give us any examples of things that are being done, positive examples of where this kind of church involvement has actually made a difference?
Well, again, you can be a member of all sorts of organisations. You can give your money to Save the Whales and, you know, that. But that action at a distance isn't the real demand. The real demand is closer to home, as I was saying. Focusing on what can I do that hurts almost, that I have to give time to, that I have to give attention to, that I have to relate to other people in the context of. In Ireland, in my own, where I'm more closely involved with this, there are one or two local communities which have taken their county development plan on board and said, what are the ethical implications for Christians in becoming involved with that? And that is a kind of a model that I think needs to be taken much more widely. I mean, communities throughout the world need to be saying, what can we do as a community to show that we're taking this biodiversity conservation action seriously?
My thanks there to Dr. John Feehan, author and professor at University College Dublin School of Biology and Environmental Science. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Thanks for listening, and do be sure to join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.